Hello, listeners, and welcome to Iris and to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, August 5th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Looking at today's weather forecast, plan on a pretty nice Friday overall. Humidity will be up a bit, and a few patches of fog may be found early in the morning. If that's the case where you are, it'll burn off quickly. Plan on highs well into the 80s this afternoon, with a few lower 90s also possible. Tomorrow continues to look hot, as highs surge into the 90s again. A heat advisory has been issued for much of the area for tomorrow afternoon due to the heat index values between 100 and 105. Scattered storms still look likely on Sunday as a cold front slowly moves through. Given such high humidity, rain totals may be heavy in portions of the area, depending on where the storms move and if they train over the same areas. Look for mainly quiet weather as we head into next week. Turning to the stories on the front page of the Courier today, Kansas results energize activists. Officers charged in fatal Breonna Taylor shooting. Democrats still in a fight for a caucus spot. And we begin reading the lead story at the top of the page. Autopsy results released. Autopsy results released in the Maquoketa Caves campground slayings. Story written by journalist Jeff Reinitz. And it begins with a photograph of the Smith family taken outside in a wooded area. The dateline is Cedar Falls. A Cedar Falls couple and their daughter, who were killed while camping last month, died of stabbing and gunshot wounds, according to autopsies. On Thursday, the Iowa Department of Public Safety released the findings of the autopsies in the July 22nd attack at Maquoketa Caves State Park campground. According to authorities, Tyler Smith, 42, died from a gunshot wound and multiple sharp force injuries. Sarah Schmidt, 42, died from multiple sharp force injuries. Their daughter, 6-year-old Lula, died from a gunshot wound and strangulation. An autopsy also confirmed that Anthony Sherwin, 23, of La Vista, Nebraska, died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound, and his death has been ruled a suicide. Quote, the investigation into the events surrounding the homicides is ongoing. However, the known facts and circumstances and all evidence collected to this point substantiate Sherwin was the perpetrator of the homicides and acted alone. Mitch Mortvedt, deputy director of the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, said in a news release, the three were killed in the early morning hours of July 22nd while they were in their tent. According to authorities, the motive remains unknown. Sherwin had been camping with his parents, and relatives said Sherwin didn't know the Smiths. The Smiths' son survived the attack. The autopsy results came days after family, friends, and others remembered the victims in a celebration of life vigil at Overman Park in Cedar Falls. Maquoketa Caves State Park reopened to the public last week. Next is a story that comes from Caleb McCullough of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau, and it is titled, Kansas Referendum Energizes Iowa Abortion Rights Activists. And the story opens with a photograph of protesters carrying signs in a gathering in June in downtown Cedar Falls, right after the U.S. Supreme Court announced its decision to end constitutional protections for abortions by overturning the Roe v. Wade ruling. Iowa abortion rights activists celebrated the results of a Kansas ballot measure on abortion rights on Tuesday, when voters roundly rejected a proposed amendment to the state's constitution that would remove protections for abortion, similar to an amendment Iowa voters may see on the ballot in 2024. Advocates said the results of the referendum show that voters, even in conservative states, in rural areas, and across party lines, broadly support abortion rights, even after the overturning of Roe v. Wade. April Clark, a board member of Iowa Abortion Access Fund, said she's confident that Iowa voters would not support an amendment removing abortion protections from the Constitution if it came to a popular vote. Quote, I would love for this to go to a popular vote in Iowa in 2024, because I think that we would have very similar results, if not even higher passage rate for it, she said. By a nearly 20-point margin, Kansas voters voted down the amendment on Tuesday, which would have changed Kansas's constitution to explicitly say the Constitution does not protect the right to abortion. Kansas's Supreme Court in 2019 ruled that abortion protections were in place in the Constitution. Abortion is currently legal in Iowa up to 20 weeks, but the legal landscape has changed in the last 4 years. Opponents of abortion rights got renewed energy after the June U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Clinic, which overturned the federal right to an abortion that had been in place since 1973. State legislators passed a resolution in 2021 that would amend the state constitution in a similar way to the Kansas proposal to establish that there is no right to an abortion in Iowa. If the same amendment is passed in 2023 or 2024, it will go to a popular vote on the 2024 ballot. The amendment came after a 2018 Iowa Supreme Court decision that found that Iowa's constitution provides a fundamental right to abortion in the state, invalidating a law that required a 72-hour waiting period for an abortion. This June, just a week before the federal decision, the court overturned its own 2018 ruling and allowed a 24-hour waiting period for an abortion to take effect, but it kept in place the, quote, unique burden standard that existed under federal law, maintaining some ability for courts to strike down abortion laws. The court noted that the standard could be litigated further depending on the result of the U.S. Supreme Court's Dobbs decision. Now, Governor Kim Reynolds is asking the court to again reconsider its standard for abortion laws, hoping the court will give the legislature broader ability to regulate abortion. But if Republicans hold onto control in the legislature and pass the amendment again, abortion rights advocates said they're hopeful that Iowa voters will reject the amendment. Quote, advocates in Iowa should feel good that in a state where the voting demographics are similar, relatively conservative, red state, that voters can make and will make the right decision, said Pete McRoberts, the policy director with the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa. Iowa and Kansas are somewhat similar electorally. Kansas has a Democratic governor, but the same party split among U.S. Senate and congressional seats as Iowa. In the 2020 election, former President Donald Trump won Kansas by 56%, and he won Iowa by 53%. According to the most recent Des Moines Register Mediacom Iowa poll, a majority of Iowa voters think abortion should be legal in most or all cases by a margin of 60% to 34%. Jennifer Confirst, the leader of the Iowa House Democrats, said if the measure ends up on the ballot in 2024, the party can learn lessons from how activists messaged around the measure in Kansas. Organizations advocating against the Kansas Amendment framed it as an extreme measure that took away rights, Confirst said in a press conference Thursday. Quote, when you tell the truth, and when you tell voters what the impact of the constitutional amendment will be, voters respond in ways that line up with what we think is right for the state, she said. McRoberts said the results from Kansas are a clear picture that support for abortion rights crosses party boundaries. He said opponents of the amendment in Kansas succeeded by making it a nonpartisan issue based on rights. Quote, Kansas is a great example of people of different political views coming to the same conclusion on fundamental rights. And that's the takeaway, he said. Groups in support of abortion restrictions said they were disappointed that the measure in Kansas failed, but they hope Iowa's leaders will continue to advance policies restricting access to abortion. Christy Judkins, the executive director of Iowa Right to Life, said Reynolds has been appointing justices to the state Supreme Court that say Iowa's constitution does not include a fundamental right to an abortion. Reynolds nominated her fifth justice to the Supreme Court last week, filling the role of the last justice nominated by a Democrat on the court. Quote, these and other factors will be taken into consideration as pro-life Iowans, as always, seek the best strategies to protect mothers and pre-born children in our state, Judkins said. Iowa Republicans are not giving specifics when it comes to their plans for future abortion legislation, but leaders have vowed to continue pursuing limits on abortion. While abortion rights advocates say they expect Republicans to support the amendment next year, legal challenges pursued by Reynolds could further erode the protections the Supreme Court left in place in June before then. Quote, Iowa House Republicans are continuing to listen to Iowans and solicit their feedback on what steps they want to see the legislature take regarding abortion next session, Iowa House Republicans spokesperson Melissa Deitch said in an email. Confirst said she hopes the amendment does not pass again before 2024, and she's hoping Democrats fill enough seats, even without a majority, to defeat the amendment. The amendment proposal passed the House in 2021 on a 53-46 vote, with the three Republicans joining all Democrats in opposition. One of three House Republicans who voted against the measure, Representative Jane Bloomingdale of Northwood, is running unopposed and will likely return to the House next year. The others were defeated in the June primary by incumbents who supported the measure after being drawn into the same district. While Iowans wouldn't vote on the amendment until 2024, Democrats in Iowa are seeing the results from Kansas as an opportunity to draw support for the midterm elections. Quote, this is an issue that Democrats are in line with the people on, and Republicans are not, Confirst said. Quote, and it's our job to remind Iowans of that. One party is here to protect your freedoms. One is trying to take it away. That's what we'll be talking about, unquote. Confirst said the vote shows that abortion rights are popular, even in counties that tend to vote Republican. Linda Uppmeyer, the co-chair of the Republican Party of Iowa, disagreed, saying in a statement that Iowa voters support Republicans' efforts to limit abortion rights. Quote, while Democrats violently push for abortion on demand and up until birth, Iowans are looking for leaders to protect innocent life, she said. She said in the midterms, voters will be focused more on inflation and economic issues, which have been front and center in Republican campaigns this year, rather than on abortion. It isn't clear whether support for abortion rights will translate to support for Democrats in November. Of the 60% of Iowans that said they support abortion rights in all or most cases, in the July Iowa poll, 24% said they would vote for Reynolds, who is currently seeking to reinstate a measure to ban abortions after 6 weeks. Quote, when Iowans cast their ballots this fall, they will not be supporting candidates who want to help Joe Biden tank the economy and unapologetically spend billions of taxpayer dollars, Oppmeyer said. The next story comes from the Associated Press. Journalist Dylan Lovin. Feds charge four police officers in fatal Breonna Taylor raid. And it begins with a photograph of Attorney General Merrick Garland speaking behind a podium. Dateline is Louisville, Kentucky. The federal government filed civil rights charges Thursday against four Louisville police officers over the drug raid that led to the death of Breonna Taylor, a black woman whose fatal shooting helped fuel the racial justice protests that rocked the nation in 2020. The charges, most of which stem from the faulty drug warrant used to search Taylor's home, are an effort to hold law enforcement accountable for the killing of the 26-year-old medical worker. One of the officers was acquitted of state charges earlier this year. Quote, Breonna Taylor should be alive today, Attorney General Merrick Garland said in announcing the charges, which include unlawful conspiracy, use of force, and obstruction of justice. The charges named former officers Joshua Janes and Brett Hankison, along with current officers Kelly Goodlett and Sergeant Kyle Meany. Louisville police said they are seeking to fire Goodlett and Meany. Hankison was the only officer charged Thursday who was on the scene the night of the killing. Taylor was shot to death by officers who knocked down her door while executing a search warrant. Taylor's boyfriend fired a shot that hit one of the officers as they came through the door, and they returned fire, striking Taylor multiple times. Hankison, Janes, and Meany had initial appearances Thursday in federal court before Magistrate Judge Regina Edwards, who set their bonds at $50,000 each, according to a court clerk official. The three men face a maximum sentence of life in prison for the civil rights charges. Calls to attorneys for Janes and Meany were not returned Thursday. It wasn't immediately known if Hankison had an attorney who could speak on his behalf. Goodlett pleaded guilty to a charge of conspiracy, Taylor family attorney Ben Grump said Thursday, though records on her court proceedings were sealed. Goodlett faces up to 5 years in prison. Local activists and members of Taylor's family celebrated the charges and thanked federal officials. Supporters gathered in a downtown park and chanted, "Say her name, Breonna Taylor." Quote, "This is a day when black women saw equal justice in America," Crump said. Taylor's mother, Tamika Palmer, said she has waited nearly 2.5 years for police to be held accountable. Quote, "Today's overdue, but it still hurts," she said. The Justice Department is also conducting a non-criminal investigation of the Louisville Police Department, announced last year, that is probing whether the department has a pattern of using excessive force and conducting unreasonable search and seizures. In the protests of 2020, Taylor's name was often shouted along with George Floyd, who was killed less than 3 months after Taylor by a Minneapolis police officer in a videotaped encounter that shocked the nation. Protesters who took to the streets over months in Louisville were especially critical of Kentucky Attorney General Danielle Cameron, who presented only wanton endangerment charges against Hankison for a grand jury to consider in 2020. Members of the grand jury later came forward to complain that Cameron's office had steered them away from charges for the other officers involved in the raid. Quote, "Thank God that Kentucky Attorney General Danielle Cameron did not get the last word in regard to justice for Breonna Taylor," Crump said Thursday. "We always said this was a conspiracy to cover up the death of Breonna Taylor. Today, the Justice Department put forth the charging documents to show we weren't crazy," unquote. Cameron, a Republican running for governor next year, said in announcing the indictment against Hankison in September 2020 that he would leave, quote, "issues regarding potential civil rights violations to federal officials to investigate." Cameron had not responded to a request for comment Thursday afternoon. Garland said the officers who were at Taylor's home just after midnight on March 13, 2020, were not involved in the drafting of the warrant and were unaware of the false and misleading statements, unquote. Hankison was indicted on 2 deprivation of rights charges, alleging he used excessive force when he retreated from Taylor's door, turned a corner, and fired 10 shots into the side of her 2-bedroom apartment. Bullets flew into a neighbor's apartment, nearly striking one man. He was acquitted by a jury of state charges earlier this year. A separate indictment said Janes and Meany both knew the warrant used to search Taylor's home had information that was false, misleading, and out of date. Both are charged with conspiracy and deprivation of rights. Janes was fired in January 2021 for violating department standards in the preparation of a search warrant execution and for being untruthful in the Taylor warrant. Former Louisville Police Sergeant John Mattingly, who was shot at Taylor's door, retired last year. Another officer, Miles Cosgrove, who investigators said fired the shot that killed Taylor, was dismissed from the department in January 2021. Taylor's boyfriend, Kenny Walker, who was in her apartment that night and fired the shot at Mattingly, was initially charged with attempted murder of a police officer, but that charge was dropped after Walker told investigators he thought an intruder was breaking into the apartment. The Taylor case also prompted a review of the city's no-knock warrant policy. Those types of warrants used in drug investigations to attempt to prevent the destruction of evidence were later banned in the city of Louisville. Our next story was filed by Aaron Murphy of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau, titled, "Still in This Fight for First in the Nation Status, Iowa Democrats Leader Says," and it begins with a photograph of Representative Ross Wilburn, Democrat from Ames, as he speaks in the 2020 outside of Iowa State Capitol in Des Moines. Dateline Des Moines. Their state party leader is keeping hope alive as Iowa Democrats wait, much longer now, to hear whether they will retain their enviable position as the first state to cast its preference for presidential candidates every 4 years. National party leaders recently announced they will delay until after the November elections an announcement on its new presidential nominating calendar. Iowa, which has been first in the nation since 1972, could get moved down the pecking order. Quote, "We're still in this fight, and we will continue this," Iowa Democratic Party Chairman Ross Wilburn said Thursday during a virtual news conference. "I'm committed to fighting for Iowa to maintain its position on the nominating calendar," unquote. Wilburn said that nothing has been decided by the National Democratic Party Rules and Bylaws Committee, and in the meantime, he will continue to make Iowa's case. Quote, "When I became chairman, we started this process. The word was Iowa's done. I can't speculate as to what the national committee members think, but no decision has been made. No calendar has been presented to the committee," Wilburn said. The National Democrats Committee originally planned to make its recommendations this week for a new early voting schedule that will feature up to 5 states. But last week, national party members announced that decision will be delayed until after the election, so the party can focus on its candidates' campaigns. That pushes the new nominating calendar decision out at least another 3 months. Quote, "My focus and our focus is on electing Iowa Democrats. We're going to continue to press for that early voting waiver and just continue to fight to maintain our position on the nominating calendar," Wilburn said. Iowa is among 16 states and Puerto Rico vying to be included in Democrats' early presidential nominating window ahead of Super Tuesday in early March 2024. The Rules Committee voted in April to reopen the presidential nominating window, forcing all interested states, including the early nominating states of Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina, to apply for a spot. The move came after the current lineup of early nominating states, led by the largely rural and predominantly white states of Iowa and New Hampshire, came under increasing fire for a lack of diversity that many Democrats say doesn't represent the party's true strength. And it follows a chaotic 2020 caucus night for Iowa Democrats when a smartphone app meant to make reporting results easier failed. As a result, the official Democratic caucus results were not reported for several weeks. The DNC is considering factors like diversity, electoral competitiveness, and logistical feasibility in making its decision. Now we turn the page to the Cedar Valley section, and the lead story is, "Tax-free is the way to be this weekend. Cedar Valley businesses prepare for the tax-free weekend." Story filed by journalist Maria Cooper, and begins with a photograph of customers shopping at the Runner's Flat in Cedar Falls on Thursday. Dateline is Cedar Falls. Businesses are preparing for this year's tax-free weekend by marking down merchandise. Clothes and shoes priced less than $100 will have no 7% sales tax, including the 1 cent local option sales tax, on Friday and Saturday. The exception applies to each article under $100, no matter how many items are sold on each receipt. Businesses open those 2 days are required to participate. Sunday is not included. Scott Gall, owner of the Runner's Flat in Cedar Falls, said his store is usually busy during the weekend. He said it's difficult with shoes, which are often more than $100, so he is marking down some to be eligible for the exception. Gall said all other apparel will also qualify. He hopes to put shoes on sale outside the store to attract customers, as long as the weather cooperates. Quote, "It's fun for us because it marks the beginning of cross-country season," Gall said. "It's more of a community party than a sale," unquote. However, shoes and apparel specifically used for sports, such as skates, cleats, helmets, and pads, are excluded from the tax exemption. Other store on Cedar Falls Parkade taking advantage of the weekend is Main Street Exchange. Owner Tracy West sets up her 50-cent sale specifically for the sales tax-free weekend. She said every year people line up outside the store, trying to be the first to get in the half-dollar deals. Staff at other businesses in downtown Cedar Falls, such as Peekaboo, Baby, and Stone Feather Road, said their stores participate in the tax-free weekend, but feel they are usually an afterthought. A list of allowed and excluded items can be found online. Apparel not eligible for tax exemption includes jewelry and watches, purses, bags, and wallets, glasses, and makeup and cosmetics. Apparel included that people may not think of are items like socks, underwear, bras, and diapers. The purchase of a gift card is already not taxable. Items sold during the tax-free period using a gift certificate will qualify for the exemption. Next, Sportsplex looks at parking changes. Story filed by Maria Cooper. Developer has 2 years to plan parking ramp and residential units near the Sportsplex, Waterloo. Changes may be coming to downtown with a potential parking ramp and apartment units. The City Council this week approved a purchasing rights agreement with Cause Related Opportunity Zone Fund, LLC, of Charles City to acquire the city-owned parking lot to the north of the Sportsplex across Jefferson Street during the next 2 years. The corporation has 24 months to make plans and present ideas to the city for the site's redevelopment. The developer's investment could be no less than $40 million. The current plan is to build a parking ramp topped by residential units. The project must replace the current parking space for the Sportsplex, Young Arena, Waterloo Center for the Arts, and other nearby businesses. Noel Anderson, Community Planning and Development Director, said the opportunity will let the business explore ways to improve the parking situation and add residential opportunities. Anderson said the city will be in talks with Main Street Waterloo about the parking situation and what the city needs. The goal, he said, is to keep parking free. The property is part of an opportunity zone, a federal program in which real estate developers receive tax incentives to build in economically distressed areas, according to the U.S. Economic Development Administration. Waterloo has three opportunity zones, the riverfront area, the downtown area, and the area near LaPorte Road and Crossroads Mall. In other business, the council approved the following: an amendment to the lease agreement with the Cedar Valley Youth Soccer Association for a 10-year extension and addition of land located at the soccer complex on West Ridgeway Avenue. The land was formerly the site of the John Deere Supervisors Club. A request by Hawkeye Community College for a site plan amendment for the construction of a 5 one-story single-family homes at Williston Field. The ordinance was before the council for the first reading, but the rules were suspended to approve second and third readings as well. A real estate purchase agreement with Union Development Holdings, LLC, for a 10.78-acre parcel of land near Homer Street to develop at least 150 multiple-family housing units, and also a $1 million grant agreement with the Otto Scheutz Foundation for the Transforming Gates and Burns Park project, awarding a $121,563 bid to Peterson Contractors Incorporated of Rhinebeck for the construction of the Martin Luther King Jr. Drive Northeast Industrial Park Wetland Mitigation. And lastly, a $749,772 contract to K&W Electric Incorporated of Cedar Falls for the 4th Street Bridge and Dam Lighting Project. Listeners, you are hearing the reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, August 5th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Waterloo. Mercedes E. Meany, 90, of Waterloo, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, August 3, 2022, at Friendship Village. Mercedes Elaine Murphy was born March 1, 1932, in Waterloo, Iowa. Mercedes was the daughter of John L. and May Connell Murphy. She graduated from Dyke High School in 1949. The Waterloo Courier wrote an article about this young man coming to Waterloo from Ireland. Thomas Murphy, Mercedes' brother, read the story with interest and shortly thereafter met the young Irishman at the Electric Park Ballroom in Waterloo. Thomas invited Michael Meany to their family farm south of Dyke for a casual Sunday dinner. It was at that dinner where Michael met his future wife, Mercedes Murphy. After a couple of years of courting, they were married at St. Edward Catholic Church in Waterloo on October 25, 1952. She was a secretary at Rath Packing Company until her occupation became full-time wife, mother, and homemaker. Mercedes's top priorities throughout her life were her devotion to the Catholic faith and her family. Mercedes enjoyed family gatherings, singing, coffee with friends, antiques, playing cards, birds, flowers, and gardening. Mercedes and Michael had 10 children together. A mass of Christian burial will be at 3 o'clock p.m. Monday, August 8th, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church, with burial in Mount Olivet Cemetery. Mass will be live-streamed. Public visitation will be from 3 o'clock p.m. until 5 o'clock p.m. Sunday, August 7th, at Haggerty Wyckoff Grawrup Funeral Home on South Street, where there will be a 5 o'clock p.m. vigil rosary service. Visitation is also for 1 hour before services at the church. The family wishes to extend a special thank you to Friendship Village and Cedar Valley Hospice, nursing and support staff, for their love and companionship during Mercedes's illness. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Sacred Heart Catholic Church, Cedar Valley Hospice, or Friendship Village. Online condolences may be left at www.haggertywaychoffgrawrup.com. Richard, known as Dick Wayne Blonigan, 75, passed away peacefully on August 1, 2022, surrounded by his family. Dick was born on August 26, 1946, in Waterloo, Iowa, to Virginia and Lester Blonigan. He began dating his bride, Cindy, in 1965, and they were married on July 30, 1966. Dick worked as a glazer, beginning his career in Waterloo, and later relocated to Des Moines, until his retirement in 2009. In his younger years, Dick was an avid bowler. On Sundays, you could find him either at the Kansas Speedway or in his chair watching the NASCAR races. Dick and his family enjoyed spending time at their lake home boating. He had a love for fishing and had many stories of memories he had made with friends and family on Lake Delhi. His pride and joy were his grandkids and his great-grandkids. Services will be held Monday, August 8, 2022, at Hamilton's on Westtown Parkway. That address is 3601 Westtown Parkway in West Des Moines, with visitation from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. and the funeral service at 12 o'clock p.m. Burial will follow at Sunset Cemetery. In Redland, Donald Eugene Soldwich, 85, of Redland, died on Tuesday, August 2, 2022, at the Cedar Valley Hospice Home in Waterloo. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, August 6, 2022, at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Redland. Burial will be held in the St. Paul Lutheran Cemetery in Redland. There will be a visitation from 4 o'clock p.m. to 7 o'clock p.m. on Friday at the church, and also for 1 hour prior to services on Saturday. Memorials may be directed to the Cedar Valley Hospice, and online condolences may be left at www.kaisercorson.com. Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Redland, and their phone number is 319-279-3551. Now here the courier lists two death notices. Miranda Lynn Held, 20, of Cedar Falls, died Tuesday, August 2, 2022. The arrangements are with Locke at Tower Park in Waterloo. And Diane L. Zabel, 62, of Sumner. She died Wednesday, August 3, 2022, at Iowa Methodist Medical Center in Des Moines. Arrangements for Diane are with Becker and Son Funeral Home in Sumner. Now in Cedar Falls, Dan C. Barfels, 72, of Cedar Falls, died on Wednesday, August 3, 2022, at the Cedar Valley Hospice Home in Waterloo. He was born October 24, 1949, in Waterloo, the son of Leo W. and Catherine L. Swartz Barfels. Dan graduated from Grinnell Community High School in 1967. He married Kathy Marson on July 15, 1978, at Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Waterloo. He worked at Progressive Tool and Die Company until they closed. Then he worked for John Deere and Company as a tool and die engineer until he retired on May of 2015. Dan enjoyed going to Florida in the winters. He enjoyed NASCAR, watching Dale Jr., and the Hendrix team. Family was extremely important, and he enjoyed the special times and going out to eat. A memorial service for Dan will be at 10:30 Monday, August 8, 2022, at Locke at Tower Park in Waterloo. Memorials are directed to the family. Condolences may be left at www.lockfuneralhome.com. Next, Tanner Robert Brown, age 37, of Warsaw, Missouri, formerly of Fredericksburg, Iowa, passed away July 25, 2022, in his home. Tanner was born on October 19, 1984, in New Hampton, Iowa, the son of David and Sharon Brown. Tanner grew up in Fredericksburg, Iowa, where he graduated from Fredericksburg High School class of 2002. Tanner proudly served as the team manager for the 2001 Fredericksburg High School State Championship football team. Following high school, Tanner worked in the restaurant industry, where he worked at the Ox Yoke Inn in Amana, Iowa. He enjoyed working and always was excited when he could be called in to work an extra shift. Tanner was a happy kid who also enjoyed volunteering his time at the VA hospital in Des Moines, Iowa. He loved being with veterans. He loved his family, playing cards, and was always joking around. He cherished his cat Buddy and his puppy Matty Joe. A celebration of life will be held at a later date near Wausau, Missouri, and Fredericksburg, Iowa. Arrangements have been entrusted to the Resser Funeral Home, Wausau, Missouri. Memorial contributions may be made to the Osage Valley Fire Department, Women's Auxiliary, in care of Resser Funeral Home, P.O. Box 910, Wausau, Missouri, 65355. That was the last obituary in today's paper. Now let's turn to the opinion section. This editorial was written by Art Cullen and appeared first on Wednesday in the Storm Lake Times Pilot, and it is titled, Take What You Can Get for the Sake of Sanity. Crazy one way like the other, it's been a manic, depressive roller coaster of volatility the past few years. Laid low by a pandemic and watching democracy under direct attack on TV, you pray that people can come together. The West is on fire, for Pete's sake, and rise out of it. So they did, or so I thought, when the voters overwhelmingly threw out that loser Donald Trump and put in Joe Biden. he talked up a new social compact, an updated New Deal, irresistible in my naive hope that mankind is capable of saving itself. Congress came together to pass the Payroll Protection Program. It saved our newspaper and so many other small businesses. Unemployment coverage was temporarily enhanced, along with family assistance. It looked like we were actually restitching the social safety net. Congress passed a huge infrastructure bill on a bipartisan basis to fix our failing bridges and water systems. Then everything came to a halt. Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, put a hand up against the train. "Too much government spending will lead to inflation," he said. He swore off climate legislation. He urged more fossil fuel production. Congress would not make permanent benefits for families and those whipsawed by a gyrating labor market. Higher wages. Tyson has gone from $18 per hour for starters to up to $21.50 in 2 years. Are eaten up by inflation in the three key areas of energy, food, and housing. Those drivers are all fueled directly by the pandemic, abnormally low interest rates for a decade, and open war in Europe. A more flexible unemployment system does not drive inflation, and neither does child care assistance. Climate change does drive food prices higher as California decrops from persistent drought, and Kansas farmers disc under this year's brown corn. The body politic thinks the nation has gone off track. You would like to dunk Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell in the Potomac, one with each hand, until they gasp for mercy. You ask yourself how Biden would squander this opportunity when the pandemic lays bare our faults so clearly. How we could not keep Manchin and Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat from Arizona, in the fold. The spirit of Sam Rayburn, mentor of Lyndon Johnson, is withered in the congressional office building named for him. Coming in, Biden tabbed Tom Vilsack as his agriculture secretary. They said that this is it, the day that agriculture and the environment find common cause, something to be celebrated. But so little happened, you would not notice. The biggest deal to come down is a carbon pipeline serving corn ethanol plants, in which Vilsack's son is involved. It made us believe that we would be left to the whims of nature and the markets after all. To hell with the polluted river, or the drought, or whatever is rolling out there where you might not be able to grow corn in just 10 years. Message from Washington, bend over and kiss yourself goodbye where the sun don't shine. 10-4. Copy that. Midterm, what difference does it make? Over and out. Just when you're ready to swallow the poison, the investment banker and Senate Majority Leader from Wall Street get on the phone to Manchin and assure Manchin, a coal operator by trade, of a shale pipeline serving West Virginia, of the possibility of drilling more on public lands, and that a tougher IRS will crack down on tax cheats. Manchin drops his opposition to climate improvements as part of a $369 billion deal. Agriculture gets $20 billion. That is not nothing. The Conservation Stewardship Program is oversubscribed 3-1. Benefits are reduced or denied for conservation efforts on working land. This will help. The Environmental Quality Incentives Program works with the CSP and gets the biggest share of that $20 billion. It could be better. Trump, for example, showered soybean growers, processors, and traders with at least $60 billion in trade disaster payments over 3 years. But $20 billion can make a real start to dousing the fires and keeping the drought at bay. A day before the climate pact was announced, the Senate agreed to reshore the semiconductor industry from Asia back to the USA. No doubt West Virginia is prime territory for a new chip factory. You take what you can get. When Representative Liz Cheney, Republican daughter of the former vice president, with a permanent snarl, calls out Donald Trump as a complete fraud, you think that this is a pretty good day for democracy. When Joe Manchin becomes a climate action hero, you think that maybe we don't have to be fuel for the pyre. You believe that we can lead ourselves out of this mess, maintain the world's longest-running democracy, and possibly not asphyxiate ourselves, at least for today. This next editorial was written by Art Cullen and appeared in the Storm Lake Times Pilot, titled Food Calms Tensions. China is Iowa's top pork customer and among the leading consumers of our soy. It also is the leading pork producer in the United States through subsidiary Smithfield Foods. Our fortunes are intertwined through trade. Food security remains China's foremost concern, and our recent trade war caused Beijing to reevaluate its dependence on both pork and soy amid a world food crisis. China is attempting to limit imports of both from us. The United States remains hamstrung by the 2018 trade war that imposed a 25% tariff on U.S. ag imports as China turns to other markets for pork, Spain, for example, and soy, Russia, which is using Chinese assistance to expand production. Meanwhile, fighter jets and gunships test Taiwan. Tensions are high. World markets are in flux. The Chinese government is under immense economic pressure thanks to a jarring COVID response. Guns are pointed at ships setting sail full of grain from Ukraine, which had been a prominent supplier of corn to China. Somehow, these ships are allowed safe passage so far by Russia, beholden to China through an agreement brokered by Turkey. These are delicate times, so it was good to hear that President Joe Biden and Chinese leader Xi Jinping spoke for more than 2 hours on the phone last week about various topics, including trade. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen also visited with the Chinese vice chairman about food security specifically. This could be the start of a return to a less hostile relationship with China, which is terribly important to global stability. Quote, hungry people are dangerous people, Roswell Garst said at the height of the Cold War. The seed corn titan hosted Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev at his Coon Rapids farm to talk about improved agriculture as the threat of nuclear war loomed. A picnic under a tent in the yard broke the ice, opened lines of communication, and ratcheted down tension. It was a side trip in diplomacy that mattered. Just a few days ago, a high-ranking Chinese official accused the United States of using food as a weapon. There was similar talk before Khrushchev's historic visit. Now would be a good time for President Biden to dispatch Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack and former Ambassador to China Terry Branstad to open a discussion with China on food security, resiliency, and sustainability. We should start with an agenda to clear out trade barriers that restrict the flow of food. We should assure China that we are a reliable supplier of protein, agricultural technology, and know-how to help fulfill rising expectations among the Chinese people. We should recommit to sharing research on livestock disease, soil and water conservation, and new crop uses in a changing climate. We must engage with China, a key player in South American development, over destruction of the Amazon rainforest as it gives way to Chinese soy and beef demand. Iowa forged ag trade paths in China. Branstad and Xi have a cordial relationship dating back to the 1980s when Xi visited a farm near Muscatine, Iowa. Iowa State University has long-standing crop science agreements in China. Because of that persistent effort to build trade, Iowa has more to lose from friction. China was shocked to realize its dependence on U.S., primarily Iowa, soy and pork. It moved to build up its grain and frozen pork reserves, and more recently has backed off U.S. pork purchases as other suppliers emerge at a lower cost. Vilsack and Branstad can do a lot to keep the lines of communication open. Iowa profits from a healthy relationship with China. Improved trade and shared understanding lead to progress on other fronts, like support for Russia and pushing for human rights. China will act like an enemy if we treat it like one. Better to come together over enhanced food security and stability, which can lead to more fruitful and rational discussions on climate and peace. turned swords into plowshares. It worked to thaw the Cold War. We need a similar spirit today. Now we turn back to local news from the Courier. Cedar Falls Utilities eyes faster vehicle charger. CFU to look into installing faster electric vehicle charger once funding becomes available. Story filed by Andy Malone. Dateline, Cedar Falls. A faster electric vehicle charger could be installed in Cedar Falls, but the local utilities company must first find the funding. The Level 3 direct current fast charger would give vehicles 3 to 20 miles per minute, compared with the already available Level 2 dual port charger on West 2nd Street, which gives vehicles 12 to 80 miles per charging hour. Quote, some say you could be ready to go in 10 to 20 minutes, said Mike Litterer, Director of Customer Service and Business Development for Cedar Falls Utilities, about the faster charger. He pointed to Iowa's Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Deployment Plan, adopted by the Department of Transportation a couple of days ago, and how its initial target area for national electric vehicle infrastructure funding includes the corridors along Interstates 80, 35, 29, and 380. These corridors were identified because they are all important for drivers taking long-distance trips. The millions of dollars in funding comes from the Federal Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. Quote, at some point, hopefully, they'll open it up for other areas, Litterer said. In the meantime, CFU continues to look at other infrastructure funding opportunities. He estimates one fast charger could cost more than $100,000 after including the transformer, electric line, and other specialized infrastructure and equipment. Quote, our first choice is to wait for a grant, Litterer said. The alternative may be to wait for a truck stop, gas station, or other business to add one, he said. In December of 2019, CFU and the city jointly funded a dual-port Level 2 charger along West 2nd Street for the public to use after paying a fee. It cost about $20,000 to install, and, on average, a vehicle will charge for 4 hours. One parking spot was designated for charging vehicles, and the city has announced plans to add a second spot adjacent to the first, after seeing an increase in usage. In the first full year, 2020 saw 401 charging sessions, and 2021 saw 561 sessions at the 2nd Street Charger, Litterer said. He estimated the station has been used anywhere from 2 to 4 times per day in 2022, or up to a total of 16 to 20 hours. Quote, at this point, we have no plans to install another Level 2, Litterer said. We think the future is the faster charger, unquote. He said the Level 3 charger would benefit people passing through Cedar Falls who want to quickly charge and be on their way. Additionally, he said, many private businesses already offer Level 2 chargers. Holiday Inn and Suites on Hudson Road has 6. Most locals already have a way to charge their electric vehicle at home, Litterer said. Our next story was filed by Jeff Reinitz. Teen found with stolen pistol, detained. Waterloo. A Waterloo teen has been detained after police found him carrying a stolen handgun on Tuesday. According to court records, police were investigating an ongoing drug and firearm case shortly after noon, Tuesday, when they attempted to stop Montavious Kentrell Saffold on the 900 block of Grant Avenue. Saffold allegedly tried to run and was detained a short time later. Police found he was carrying a loaded 9mm pistol that had been reported stolen. A search of his home on Grant Avenue produced significant amounts of marijuana and a digital scale, record state. Saffold, 17, was charged with felon in possession of a firearm, carrying weapons, fourth-degree theft, and possession of marijuana with intent to deliver. He was charged as an adult. Court records state Saffold was detained in October for a charge of possession of a sawed-off shotgun after police responded to a disturbance at his house and found a single-shot 20-gauge shotgun under his mattress. Man is arrested for taking copper pipe and wire from a vacant home. This story filed by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo man has been arrested for allegedly stealing copper pipes and other items from a vacant home. Police arrested Derek Allen Moore, 36, on charges of third-degree burglary, possession of burglary tools, assault on a police officer with a weapon, interference while armed, and eluding. Bond was set at $17,000. According to court records, patrol officers stopped Moore in a Toyota RAV4, leaving Butler Avenue home known as a target for burglars, around 8:40 p.m. Sunday. The Toyota turned down Dubuque Road and hit speeds of up to 75 miles per hour in a 35-mile-per-hour zone before driving off-road and disappearing. Officers later found the vehicle parked at Moore's home at 1502 Schultz Street. When police approached Moore, he allegedly threatened them with a bar stool. Officers recovered pipes, wires, and a TV that had been inside the house, along with other items. And now, listeners, that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, August 5th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.